This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. And when the people speak, we make a difference. We know this. People like Cindy and Craig Corey know this. They have been making a difference ever since their daughter, Rachel, who was a 23-year-old American peace activist from Olympia, Washington, was crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer on March 16th of 2003. She was killed while undertaking a nonviolent direct action to protect the home of a Palestinian family from demolition. The day after Rachel's death, in a phone conversation, Ariel Sharon promised President Bush a thorough, transparent, and credible investigation of Rachel's death, which Rachel's parents felt never happened. It still really hasn't happened, has it, Craig and Cindy?
Well, it's not just our opinion, but it continues to be the government's opinion that it hasn't happened. So first, in a letter from the State Department, Colin Powell's chief of staff told us, Larry Wilkerson told us that in his opinion, he could say without equivocation, it had not been a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation. And that opinion was reiterated under the Secretary... that came after Powell. Who am I trying to say?
Condoleezza Rice.
Yes, and then also recently, the Vice President's chief on. Tony Blinken reiterated that that still is the position of the U.S. government. So it's not like just the family didn't feel like it had been a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation, but our government maintains that position, and, of course, we are currently in court and finding out just how poor that investigation has been.
Well, let me ask you, currently you are, there is being conducted a civil case lawsuit against the state. Is it technically against the state of Israel?
It's against the state of Israel and the Ministry of Defense. So the Israeli military and the state of Israel, yes.
And one of the things that, as I have been reading some of the trial updates on the RachelCoreyFoundation.org, for those of you listeners who would like to look, it's a fascinating read. It's quite incredible what I've been reading on there. When they talk about transparency, one of the first things that you state and discuss is the lack of transparency based on one of the most unbelievable things I've ever heard, that you're not even able to look your daughter's killer in the eye, that he was hidden behind some kind of a sheet of plastic or something so that no one would see who he was?
To go back just a little bit, Craig and I and our family, our children, other children, filed this lawsuit in 2005. And it was not an easy decision for us to make, but we had spent already 2 years trying to find some accountability through working, with the U.S. government and the Israeli government, with the U.S. actually working with the Israeli government. And when the position of our own country, as we talked about earlier, was that there hadn't been even a proper investigation in Rachel's case, we felt compelled to take the legal steps that we had the opportunity to take, because in Rachel's case, there was a military police investigation. which happened in 2003. Because of that, and because they found no fault at all, they closed the case and declined to release the report of it to the U.S. government, although some officials were able to read it. Our family was eventually able to read it. There couldn't be a criminal proceeding. The military police investigation precluded that. So in 2005, really one of the very limited legal options that we had was to bring this civil lawsuit. And so we filed it in that year, almost exactly 2 years after Rachel had been killed. Everything proceeded very, very slowly. And then the Israeli Knesset, passed a law that made it impossible for anybody who was injured in an area of conflict, which they defined, but of course it was in Gaza and the West Bank and wherever else they might define, to bring suit against the Israeli government. And that law was passed, and so it halted all any kind of legal proceedings. There were many human rights organizations who then objected to that and brought a case before the Israeli Supreme Court, and eventually a portion of the law was overturned. And then our suit started forward
From that point on.
Yeah, but it's taken a very long time. But in 2008, to get to your question, Ehud Barak, the defense minister, signed a security certificate, which the state had sought in our case, which meant that they could keep a great deal of information about the people involved secret. And this includes their names and other identifying information, which would make some sense. But then when we came to court, and we didn't, this didn't happen in the case until this fall, they utilized this security certificate to ask the judge to have the witnesses, the driver of the bulldozer, the commander of the bulldozer, and other witnesses who were on the ground that day, testify from behind a screen. And we appealed
without
that.
Even knowing their names, Cindy?
No, we don't. I mean, we. It's possible, you know, for. We do have some information, but it's very limited. But
and we're not really allowed to use it right now.
And also in court, the witnesses are all except for a very public witnesses like the chief investigator in the case was named, and some of their military experts and so forth. They have testified openly, and we do hear their names. But the other military people that were involved that day, we hear only their initials, their identifying initials. And when the driver and the commander of the bulldozer testified, as well as soldiers who were in the second bulldozer that was on the ground that day, they testified from behind this screen.
May I ask you, Cindy? Have you ever heard of another case in which this certificate was enforced or put into, or the testifying people were put under a screen like this?
I imagine that it has been used before. Our attorneys were surprised by it at the time. I know when they heard that this was going to happen, they said that it's very unusual, I think, for it to happen in a case in Israel that people would testify from behind a screen. I think, you know, sometimes it happens in the U.S. as well, in cases where people who are engaged in surveillance and that kind of thing, if they're testifying and having their identities revealed, would be damaging in some way. But I think it is unusual. It's not completely unheard of there.
I would think it would be even more unusual considering this was a civil case. A lawsuit, not a criminal trial, is it not?
I think I don't really know the answer to that, but it would seem true to me. One thing about our bringing this against the State of Israel and the Ministry of Defense that I didn't that I see now as a positive. I don't think I realized it until we actually got into court. But for me, the fact that this isn't just about one soldier or two soldiers or even a few, it really is about the military and the state of Israel and the policies that allow the sort of thing that happened to Rachel and that happens to so many others to mm-hmm. occur there.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's become a positive. I feel like one of the most productive things about what we're doing is that we're shedding light on this entire system, and it's been very informing.
I think just to sort of to follow up on Cindy's thought a little bit there at the end and tie it back, one of the things when you have the military investigating itself and really not a credible investigation, the idea of a civil suit where our attorney is allowed to ask questions and follow-up questions and follow-up questions, the follow-up questions of the witnesses, that's really our only way of bypassing the other system. So we at least have we can't really do an investigation, but we do have the ability to ask the questions that are very logical, and so many of the state's witnesses have completely contradicted themselves several times over on the witness stand, and of course that wouldn't come out would not necessarily come out if you were talking about a criminal investigation, where again you'd still have the same investigative team, you'd still have essentially the government, you know, investigating itself, and that might not come out.
Well, now I would like to get into some of the details of the trial, but before that, I would like our audience to know that obviously, since Cindy and Craig have taken up their daughter Rachel's cause and case. In her defense, what is the award that you are asking for at the outcome of this lawsuit? For those who don't know,
I think there's actually some confusion about all of that. So I'm glad to have the opportunity for us to clarify it a bit. Craig may chime in a bit because it's a little difficult to explain, not being an attorney. But there are, mm-hmm. in this kind of lawsuit, there are three types of damages that are awarded if there is, if there would be any finding in our favor. There are punitive damages. There are damages that are have to do just with the cost of the whole experience of a trial and so forth. And then there are damages that in the U.S. I think we would equate with pain and suffering. And Craig, maybe you can explain the differences between those.
Yeah, well, of course, just the actual cost. So that's the cost of sort of trying to put a monetary value on the cost of killing someone, which is pretty ugly, but is still some there. Some obvious ones would be just repatriating her body and something, you know, mm-hmm. a funeral and things mm-hmm. like that, loss of wages, I suppose. And so you put some sort of dollar amount on that, and then pain and suffering, which is much more nebulous, and then punitive damages. And actually, there was a part of the trial this spring where we were, it's also convoluted, it's kind of hard to go into, but we were pursuing some testimony and questions of the person that did the autopsy, the doctor that did the autopsy on Rachel's body. And what we found out when we were questioning him, and at least our family didn't realize, is that he'd taken body tissue, at least, and kept mm-hmm. it. So not all of Rachel's body is at this point been repatriated and brought home, and we didn't know that, and we wanted to follow up on that questioning, and the judge said, well, but doesn't have anything to do with how Rachel was killed. That's not at issue here, and he wanted to stop that questioning, and our attorney said, well, but it goes to the evidence and damage evidence, and that is in the trial, and they said, well, where's the money that's involved in that? And our attorney said, well, punitive damages. And then the judge said, well, how much you were asking for, and we said we hadn't set that. The judge gave us 5 minutes to determine what we wanted for punitive damages. And so the family talked it over with our attorneys. And our feeling all along is it isn't about money. We just simply wanted to continue the questioning. So we came back in and said $1. So some of that $1, people took that to mean that's the entirety of the lawsuit, but that is the entirety of the punitive damage portion of the lawsuit to be real fair about it. And we were successful. The attorney, our attorney, explained that to the judge, of course in Hebrew, so I couldn't understand him directly. But watching the judge's body language, he nodded his head and sort of smiled, and we got to continue questioning this doctor so we could go along and try to find out what we could. We still haven't. That was in March of last year, mm-hmm. and we have still not really found out either what body parts he has, where he's kept them. At the time, he'd forgotten and thought maybe they'd been buried with other people's body parts, or he just didn't know. But then later they said they had saved them for the military, not for our family.
Would you be going after the recovery of those body parts?
Yes, we are. But that's been kind of slow because of the rest of the trial. But and that institute has not really answered our just questions of what do you have, how do we get it back, sort of thing. So I don't know what that process is going to end up being, but we will pursue it.
Now, this whole process has been hindered also by some kind of an attorney strike. I think it was the state attorney strike that's been going on in Israel.
That's
how
right.
long has that been going on, and how did that affect the trial?
We were last in court on November 4th. And we learned on that day, there had been some scheduled dates later in November, but we learned on that day that those dates were not going to happen. And at that point, it happened that I was coming back to speak for something I'd promised, I think almost over a year ago, in Michigan for the Michigan Peace Team. So rather than returning to Israel right away again, as I had originally intended to do, I just stayed in the U.S., and then Craig joined me here. We expected, because of the what had been determined in court that November 4th date, that we would be back there on December 22nd and 23rd for court dates. We learned just a couple of days before we were due to fly back on December 17th that those trial dates were also canceled, and that was because of this attorney's strike. It began sometime after we left. I think it lasted for something over 40 days. It's a state attorney's strike. There were, I think, over 800 employees or state attorneys who were on strike. So, of course, it impacted everything that was happening in the courts, and we're still trying to determine when our next court dates will be. Our attorneys are, we've had some discussion with them, and they will be talking with the court and with the state's attorneys to determine when we'll be back in court. There are still six witnesses named by the state who will be, who have yet to testify.
All right, let me ask you, obviously you found some very very fascinating and quite important things, the issue with the body parts. What outside of that, which is huge as far as I'm concerned, outside of that, have you seen anything or heard anything from the testifying agents that has really just blown you away?
A couple of, let me just start because it also is related to what happened at the Abu Kabir Institute where Rachel's body was autopsied. We, in the first day or so after Rachel was killed, we were told that if we didn't authorize an autopsy, that her body might not be returned to the U.S. And the Iraq War was starting shortly after that. Everybody was very concerned about how people were going to be moving in and out of Israel in any case. But with our congressman, Congressman Brian Baird, in his office, and listening to him by telephone, we agreed to the autopsy, but said that it had to be done with somebody from the U.S. Embassy present. There had to be a U.S. consular present presence at the autopsy for it to go ahead. And also,
and, is
it,
and briefly,
not,
is that common practice?
I don't know that it's common practice, but I don't think that it's unusual to have people. I've talked, actually, I have a friend in Seattle who is an attorney and worked with human rights organizations in Gaza and the West Bank, and she witnessed autopsies at this same institute. So it's not unusual for that sort of thing to happen. And that was our requirement, along with that it not be done by a doctor who is with the military. And what we've subsequently learned, and even that week, we knew that for some reason we were in court in Israel. We didn't quite understand at the time why it was, but our congressman explained he thought that the court was trying to make sure that our wishes were being considered as this happened. So for a long while, we assumed that our wishes had been met. But what we confirmed in the court was that Dr. Hiss performed the autopsy without any U.S. consular presence at all. And what's more, in the military report that came out that we were able to read, the conclusions were actually made public finally after the U.S. government placed pressure on the Israelis to release something about the investigation. And in that, they stated that there was somebody from the embassy present, and in fact there was not anyone there at all. So
there was not, and that was what do you consider that a lie, a deliberate lie, or do you consider that a mistake?
I consider it. I guess I find it. Amazing, I mean, that it would get into this report that they wrote, although it's a military police, a high-level military police official that's writing the report, but they have documentation from the autopsy doctor. They had called, we know now from their log, they had called the autopsy doctor earlier, actually before the report came out. So I don't know. It seems to me if it had just been omitted, if they hadn't addressed it, that might be one thing, but to have it stated in the report that somebody was present, you would think that somebody responsibly creating such a report would try to verify that had happened. So I guess I do think it was a lie. It was certainly not factually correct.
It was more than, maybe Cindy said this, but it was more than just simply our request. That was a requirement of the court that allowed the autopsy to be done. They gave them permission for that. So they violated their own court order. And when the doctor doing the autopsy, Professor Hiss, was asked, you know, why didn't you go back and get a new court order? You know, he said he couldn't get the anybody from the embassy to come. That's controversial, to say the least. But there's this court order that he disobeyed. He just said he couldn't be bothered to go back to the court. That, to me, is extraordinary. And it also sort of says why you might write in a report that there was somebody there when there wasn't, because, of course, the autopsy was illegal. And because they didn't follow the court's instructions.
I think overall, one of the things that has become so clear to us is that from the very beginning, this military police investigation, rather than setting out to find out exactly what happened and why it happened on March 16th, 2003, what we are seeing over and over again in court is that the investigation set out to prove that the Israeli military had no responsibility, basically, and that Rachel herself was responsible for her own killing.
Just amazing. If I'm not mistaken, I think that probably one of the things that I found most interesting and to me sets the tone for the entirety of the case, of the civil court case, as well as the actual events that surrounded Rachel's death, is when an Israeli military colonel stated that and I'm quoting this, there are no civilians in war zones. That is an amazingly callous statement. And if that's the truth, then is that also true in the case of Israeli death? Or is this only in the case of Rachel or people that die via the hand of Israel?
I guess I wouldn't want to go into what I, you know, sort of sounds
speculation.
Sarcastic.
I think what is correct
is that they're obviously under law, and in reality, there are civilians in war zones all the time. And we have a set of international laws, and I think in the United States and in Israel, they have domestic laws that talk about that. So so the colonel is absolutely wrong, and I think the whole world needs to stand up for those rules and laws, even though they're often broken, to make that sort of statement. And coming from a colonel, as I think you were pointing out, and a colonel who actually has before this written the rules of engagement for heavy machinery, so the big bulldozers that were down there, he wrote the rules of engagement for those in that area. And that's his attitude, one that's just completely illegal under international law. I think that says a lot about what was going on down there, if that's the tone set by field grade officers. And it means also that the lawsuit and some of the things that are being questioned by our lawsuit is far larger than Rachel and just really needs to be... to go forward. So of course, there are civilians, you know, on both sides of the green line. Of course they are. And in the house that Rachel stood in front of, let's be really clear, there were five little children behind the wall Rachel stood in front of. There were four adults, their parents, of those two families. And luckily, the bulldozer stopped before it crushed the wall. So those kids, and there's been another baby born to that family, those kids have grown up, and they're who I think of when people say there's no civilian in a war zone. I think of a little six-year-old girl holding a rabbit there when their house was still standing the first time we met her, and she's now 13. Well, last time we saw her, she was 13. She's probably 14 now. You know, just a family like any other family, I guess, is one thing I like people here in the United States to know. Their older brother, the oldest of those children, when Rachel knew then, he is, I think, about 11 or 12 years old. And she would help him with his English homework, and he would help her learn Arabic. And when we were in Gaza last year and saw him, he's now in college, and he just changed his major to English. And so that's, to me, that's a really heartwarming and very human story.
And there are a million human stories, and no less or no more human, I guess, than Rachel's. But to you, her parents, may I ask you, have there been witnesses allowed in favor of the case for your side?
The case, as your listeners may know, began in the Israeli courts in Haifa. It's the Haifa District Court.
PBS Radio.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the People Speak Radio. I apologize for the inconvenience. Who knows? It could have been the weather gods that are spreading havoc all over the eastern border. But welcome back, Craig and Cindy Corey, who are advocating and speaking on behalf of their slain daughter and peace activist, Rachel Corey, on March 16th of 2003. Just before we lost you, I wanted to ask if you had any advocates, if you had any witnesses on behalf of the people such as the ISM group that was with Cindy, with Rachel on the day of her death?
There were seven international eyewitnesses who were with Rachel in Gaza when she was killed, and four of them testified in March. The lawsuit in Haifa District Court began on March 10th, so we've been at this for a long while. All four of them had the opportunity. They were questioned at length largely by the state's attorneys. One thing that's very different between our court systems is that in Israel, and at least in our case, but I think it's usual probably in a lot of cases, witnesses prepare affidavits that come to the court, and that becomes sworn testimony. So all of our eyewitnesses wrote statements about what had occurred on March 16th, and that became the first testimony that went into the court. And then the proceedings began with the state's attorneys questioning our eyewitnesses. Our attorneys then were able to do redirect, which is very limited questioning that can only apply to what the state's attorneys have asked about and that needs further mm-hmm. clarification. So in March, mostly what we heard were the state's attorneys questioning our witnesses, and I would say that all four of the ISM I thought were extraordinary in certainly what they shared. In some ways, there was little discussion about what actually happened to Rachel. It didn't seem like the attorneys wanted to question too much about that. They spent time trying to question ISM and the motivations of the people there. But these are all really, I think, stellar individuals. When Rachel was killed, I didn't know ISMers except her. I knew one other woman who lived where we were at the time in Charlotte, North Carolina, who was 40 years old and had kids, and she had gone as an ISMer in December of 2002. But now, you know, in these past years, we've come to know all of the people who were with Rachel, plus hundreds of others that we meet all over the country and the world. And those who are still doing that very brave and important work. And I feel like our witnesses represented themselves and what they and Rachel were doing very, very well. I think Craig and I were both very proud of them. We did call an expert witness to talk about the bulldozer. We called Dr. Hiss, who was the autopsy doctor. We tried to have the doctor who treated Rachel, who was with Rachel in Gaza, but we weren't able to allow him to. The Israelis didn't allow him to come out. His statement was accepted into the record, however, so that is on record. And we called also one of the investigators. There were three investigators, a lead investigator, and then two very young other investigators who were part of the military police investigation into Rachel's case. And the two young investigators had, I think, 3 months or less of training and investigation.
Cindy, this sounds almost like a kangaroo court. I mean, obviously there are some things that are not precedent setting, such as having witnesses' identities sealed, but people not being able to come into the country to place their statements, pubescent attorneys handling the case. Just goes on and on, calling people by first names only and not knowing their identity. It just sounds like some kind of a kangaroo court situation.
Well, one of the things I wanted to make sure people knew, too, is that the lead investigator made a comment at the end of his testimony that was as extraordinary as what Yossi, the person who, the colonel, who talked about no civilians in war. The lead investigator in the case said at the close of his testimony that he believed that the Israeli government was at war with everyone in Gaza, including the peace activists. So this is the person that's supposed to be conducting an objective investigation into what occurred. And yet, you know, he said it in a different way, but he also was saying that there are no civilians.
Before we get into some of our listeners' questions, and we have a bunch already, I do want to know one thing. What language is the trial being held in?
It's in all in Hebrew. So we have friends who, mostly Jewish Israelis, who translate for us while it's going on. So there are people kind of whispering in our ears as we hear it. And then it's being the voices are being recorded. So then a transcript is made of that in Hebrew. And then we get friends, we hire people to translate that into English. I'd also kind of like to correct Cindy on one of the things. The doctor in Gaza, eventually it was agreed that he would be allowed to come to the trial, but when they were trying to get information then to the government, all the government wanted to know, to let him in, to talk about it, is what his telephone number was, not his identification information. So at that point, we all sort of backtracked because we really were afraid for this doctor's safety coming into Israel and how much questioning he would get. It just wasn't any way for us, or I suppose the court, to guarantee this Palestinian doctor from Gaza's that he wouldn't be taken aside and questioned or whatever once he got into Israel. So they just simply accepted his written testimony without any cross-examination, which is that's probably a pretty good outcome, but the reason for it is pretty appalling.
Yes, all of it is appalling, and there's a lot of contradictions in all of the testimony. This is one of the out of all of the things that I have seemed to understand is that there is one contradiction after another in every witness and testimony that's been had throughout this investigation, isn't there?
Yeah, it's we've seen what affidavits that the eyewitnesses, the Israeli military eyewitnesses, wrote shortly after, in the probably 4 weeks after Rachel was killed, or 2.5 weeks, maybe it's more like it. And then we've seen what they've done for this trial. So what was been written in 2010 for the trial, because each one presents an affidavit and signs it. What's interesting is what's done for the trial. They use the same phrases are used over and over again. So it's pretty obvious that the attorneys are writing these, and I'm not sure that's entirely unusual. You know, presumably it's taken from the statements that the witnesses are making, and that they agree that it's true. Which was pretty extraordinary, is that sometimes the more recent written statements would contradict the older statements. Often under cross-examination, the witnesses would contradict what they said right after Rachel was killed. And what was extraordinary is that sometimes they acted as if they had no idea what they had just submitted to the court, what had just been done a few weeks or months prior to the coming into court. And in one case, it was the commander of the bulldozer that killed Rachel. Our attorney asked him about the houses that had been demolished along the border, and he said that there weren't any. And our attorney said, well, but you said that they were. And he said, I never said such a thing. And so the attorney showed him his affidavit from I believe it was in April of 2003. And the person said, well, that's not my signature. He denied that it was his signature on what we had from before. And the state's attorney was willing to agree that it was his signature. But, of course, if it's not his signature, nobody can agree that it is. And if it's not, then that it calls into question the people doing an investigation. So it was at times just ludicrous, all the contradictions, not just one witness with another. Not just, for instance, you would expect maybe that the military witnesses would contradict our witnesses, and they did, but they would contradict each other, and then they would contradict themselves. And
is there an Israeli word or a Hebrew word for perjury?
I don't know.
Well, you know, we have a number of questions from our listeners, and I really would like to get those in. Mike in California asked, do you still have anger over what you consider your daughter's wrongful death, and how do you deal with it?
I think, you know, we've had 8 years to live with this, and we live with it every day, every hour of every day. It doesn't go away, but in so many ways, I think Craig and I feel really blessed, continue to feel blessed and privileged, as Rachel felt, because we have tremendous support from people all over this country and all over the world. Rachel left us with incredible opportunity. I wish the terrible problems that caused her to make this journey in the first place were corrected, but they haven't been. And so the work and the focus continues for us, and we just feel fortunate that we're able to do that. Very early on, I think, and Craig articulated this very early, I think, for us, but I think for both of us, we realized that if we allowed if we focused on the anger and on hatred or on vengeance even, and all of those kinds of things that sometimes do come into play in situations like this, that we would only destroy ourselves. And so I think with the help of so many people, we've largely been able to avoid that. That doesn't mean, I mean, we're human beings. We're all human beings. And there are times when we're angry, but I think it has more to do sometimes with the bureaucracy. I mean, sometimes with what we see happening in our own country, how we can see these wrongs and they're so apparent, and yet the policies that support them, the money that supports it, continues to flow. I think we can get very frustrated with that, even though in working on this, we also encounter people in government and elsewhere that are doing very good, caring work. But so it isn't that we don't ever kind of explode at some incident or something that happens, but I think we try very hard to focus on the larger reason for why we're still pursuing this, certainly for Rachel, because she deserves it, but also because of all the others, and because people are still dying. And right now, I mean, we're particularly concerned about what's happening to nonviolent protesters in the West Bank and farmers in Gaza, and nonviolent protesters who have been killed, like Jawahar Abu Rahma. We've been to Baleen. We've met those people from that family. And and then also the ones who are in prison, and Craig can talk about it, is meeting with Abdullah Abu Rahma, who's been in prison now for having tear gas canisters as a kind of collection.
Yeah, I think you know, for all the anger you can have about this sort of thing, the other side of it is we just meet extraordinary people, and. And it gives you a different picture, I think, of in some ways, of a situation which the world looks at it as, I guess, you know, Israel versus Palestinian, or maybe Jew versus Arab, or even Muslim, or something like that. And we've met extraordinary people from all those sides. I mean, I view and did from the beginning as a human rights violation. And so what we're talking about is people that are working to make sure that human rights are respected wherever, they're human.
Wow.
You know, they have those rights, and those include Jews and Arabs and Americans and everybody, and then people that are willing to violate anybody's human rights for some sort of political or geographic advantage, and that includes Jews and Arabs and Americans and everybody. You learn that early, but the extraordinary people that we've met from the first day, I mean, we got, I think, 10,000 emails came in to Cindy in the week that Rachel was killed. And I remember we weren't really watching that, but our kids were a little bit. And my son pulled us aside and he said, you need to hear this one. It was, and we may have met Bernie in Chicago. That's the name I remember, but I don't ever remember meeting him later. We've been to Chicago several times. But Bernie in Chicago wrote, he said, I lost a half-sister in the Holocaust. He said, I will live the rest of my life now for two Rachels, my half-sister and your daughter. You know, and that's
absolutely
just some stranger
that,
reaching out to us in the a day after Rachel was killed.
Well, I'll tell
and
you,
it's happened over
Rachel
and over.
Rachel is a hero to myself as a Palestinian American. I know she is a hero to our community. I appreciate you being with us. We would like to invite you back upon the completion of this trial so that we can discuss further some of the things that you may or may not have been able to talk about. And I'm afraid we're going to have to call it an evening right now. We have another a guest that is going to be talking about an event here in the metropolitan Detroit area in Dearborn, George Galloway. Rachel was an inspiration to all people, not just Palestinians, Craig and Cindy. And you as a family have really been offered a gift in this child. So we appreciate you. Thank you. And we would like to have you back on soon.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
You have a great evening. Ladies and gentlemen, we Muhammad Kazaz with us this evening. Muhammad will be... hi, Muhammad.
Hi. How are you, everybody?
I'm great. How are you?
Good.
I hope... We here in Michigan are enjoying an incredible snowstorm, and I think Muhammad is still driving in it. Muhammad, would you like to... yeah. Would you like to talk to our audience about your upcoming event?
Yes. First of all, thank you for giving us the opportunity to be on the radio show and to promote this event.
My pleasure.
This event will be taking place in Dearborn, January 22nd. It's for U.S. Boat to Gaza and Viva Palestina, which we're trying to raise money, funds to launch a United States ship to go to the Mediterranean Sea, which they're going to meet with other ships from Europe, and then they're going to go all together to Gaza and hopefully break the siege on the Muslim for All. And hopefully this time the international committee will focus more on this because, you know, that this is going to have a United States, and we're hoping also to have a Canadian ship, but that's not part of the plan this time.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me who's going to be in attendance and who your guest speakers are going to be at this event?
Yes, the guest speaker will be George Galloway from Viva Palestina. I think the majority of the listening group know who George Galloway is, especially mm-hmm. Palestinians. I mean, this guy has been working for the Palestinian cause forever. And we have Shadia Mansour and Sound of Reason as of now who will be performing. Shadia Mansour is an activist. She's a singer, artist, Palestinian, and she's coming from Britain. She's very, really, really good. And Sound of Reason, they're coming from Canada. I'm not sure as of now if we're going to be having both, but for now we are having both. So,
That's wonderful. And obviously there's always a factor when it comes to Palestinians or friends of Palestinians traveling here and there. We tend to be picked a lot more randomly than most random people, don't we, Muhammad?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All the time. It's not, for some reason, I don't know why. I think it's the color of our skin. Or it says on our foreheads, we're Palestinian. I don't know.
Wonderful. And the event will be starting at what time and where will you be hosting it?
It's going to be at 6 o'clock, Greenfield Manor. It's on Greenfield Road. And it's going to be from 6 to 10 o'clock, should be. So.
Well, that's amazing. I am certainly going to do my best to be there. And I appreciate your coming on our show and being with us this evening. So that's all, folks. This is going to be an event for Viva Palestina with George Galloway as the main guest speaker. Come join us for this fundraiser. It's an important event. It will hopefully eventually help end the siege in Gaza. And how long, briefly, how long has the siege now been going on, Muhammad? Do you know exactly how long it is?
You know, it's been going on. You know, people tend to say from the war, the 2008-2009 war, if you guys remember this, but it's been going on before that even. But, yeah. You know, they had some open water, but now it's all closed off. I mean,
yeah.
It's all over Palestine. I mean, now the wall is still being built in and around Jerusalem and all over the place. You know, and we need to support this cause.
We certainly need to support this cause. And thank you, Muhammad, for being on our show tonight. It was a pleasure. I wish you luck, and I'll be in contact with you this week to see how things are going. I've been spreading the word as well. Ladies and gentlemen, next week's show, Tuesday night, we will have representatives of the Afghans for Peace live from the USA and from Afghanistan. So please be with us at 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the People Speak Radio. Thank you very much. This is Basma Farhat. And when the people speak, we make a difference. So keep on speaking. Thank you and good night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the stable by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you. And